Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
I would love just for the listeners to hear the process that you go through, because I think it's unlike anyone else's process that I've ever heard.
Cool.
That's very evocative.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you a starting point.
Okay.
Like a summer day in the smell of hay.
I want it to feel like an uplifting summer country song, you know? I think it should have a little bit of chamomile in it. Mm-hmm. I think it should have like maybe something malty, like even like we can use some brewer's malts. Start combining those together, something, a little bit of lemon, maybe some raspberry.
That's an ice cream I'll eat.
Meat and three.
One meat, three sides.
Food, news, and storytelling.
A square meal for your ears.
Meat and three.
Welcome to Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. I'm your host and executive director of HRN, Katie Mosman-Wadler. Recently, our team traveled to Feast Portland, a West Coast food festival that showcases truly delicious bites and deep talks about the current state of the food and beverage industry. Since 2012, the festival has also raised over $500,000 to help fight hunger. Today, we'll bring you some highlights from our conversations there, with a particular focus on what food business success looks like today. At the top of the show, you heard Dana Cowan in conversation with Salt and Straw co-founder Tyler Malik. We'll hear more from their flavorful conversation later in the show. First up, however, you'll hear a bit from my chat with Gabi Dalkin, an LA-based food blogger, about her professional journey.
So I went to culinary school just out of college, really on a whim. I was doing it to avoid getting another job. I had no intention of going into the food world afterwards, but I started my blog and I started working as a private chef during culinary school. And so when I finished and graduated, I just stayed. Like, I stayed working as a private chef, which was the income, and I started, and What's Gotta Be Cooking was chugging along, making 12 cents a day. So, like, that was just for fun. Just
rolling in.
My mom, who's here, was the only person that commented on my site for, like, years. and so it was, What's Gotta Be Cooking just slow rolled for that was 8 or 9 years ago. And it morphed. I quit personal chefing eventually, and it morphed into like one cookbook and then two cookbooks, and I started working with brands on different collaborations. I have a line of products sold at Williams-Sonoma. I write food guides to cities. Like, I wouldn't say like I'm a classic food writer. Like, I'm not writing for the Times or anything like that, but I feel like I'm making food accessible for my audience and bringing them into my world and giving and like letting them not be intimidated by the kitchen.
Yeah.
Did that answer the question?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And the role of the classic food writer is changing.
Yeah, and it changes all the time. Like, mm-hmm. For What's Gotta Be Cooking, we used to do a weekly Snapchat show on Fridays at noon when Snapchat was still a thing. And then when IG Stories and IG Live came out, my audience was vastly bigger over there. So I switched over, and now we do like a live cooking show every Monday night at 6 p.m. And it's like there's you're just always creating content, whether that's in visual, video, writing, whatever it is. It's an ever-changing job.
Yeah.
It can also be a tough career to keep going.
I can tell you every single one of like most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit with very quickly afterwards.
What are the top reasons that they quit?
Well, I think people look at food blogging and think, A, oh, you make decent money and it looks like so much fun. You're out like doing all these cool things. You get to work with amazing brands. But I don't think they realize how much work actually goes into it, and that I haven't taken it. Most people haven't taken it. I mean, I personally haven't taken a day off in like 7 years. We were in Patagonia earlier this year with my family and we were like hiking some crazy 8-hour hike, and I was emailing Margo from William Sonoma about something I need, like whatever. Like I just, you don't stop, you don't turn off, you don't have people working for you, so you're always on.
Right.
So that's probably the biggest reason people quit, is because of the time commitment. And it's also not an overnight thing. It took me probably 6 years for What's Gotta Be Cooking to churn enough of an income to walk away from private chefing and feel not terrified to go to bed every night that I wasn't going to have any money in my bank account the next day.
And do you give advice for kind of fledgling food bloggers?
Yeah.
What are your like top advice pieces that you give out?
Don't start it for the money, because that will take you a really long time. Mm-hmm. And B, figure out what your voice is. Like for the first couple years of What's Gotta Be Cooking, I couldn't tell you what my brand was because I was just figuring it out. And that's okay, but eventually you have to figure out who you are and what you stand for, and make your, like, you're the only person who can tell your story, so figure out what you want to say, and then do it.
Yeah.
So those are my top two pieces of advice.
Thank you.
And take photos in natural light.
Like outside. Go outside.
Next up is Megan Sanchez, a Portland-based chef and the co-owner and creative director of Guero. During the festival, we got to try one of her amazing tortas, a delicious pork belly BLT that we're still dreaming about. Equally impressive is how Megan turned her food truck into a very popular brick-and-mortar restaurant. Hannah Forden found out how she did it.
We opened 2.5 years ago in our brick-and-mortar. We started in a food cart before that, and yeah, we've been selling tortas in Portland for the last 8 years now.
Awesome. So tell me about the transition from food truck to restaurant. That
yeah.
is quite a big shift.
Yes.
How did you make that decision, and what sort of changes did you have to make to the way that you kind of ran your business and made your food?
It was a simple decision. We had outgrown every system, every physical space, storage, everything that we had was just bursting at the seams. So when an opportunity to move into a brick and mortar space just a couple blocks from where we were. We're very tied to our block and our community right there in our neighborhood. So moving across town probably wasn't going to be an option for us, but we found this space and it was just so simple.
The stars aligned.
We're like, we need it. Yeah, we got to have it. And we were ready, and our customers supported us through that transition so beautifully. It's been amazing. It's nice to, you know, as you noticed, it rains in Portland a lot, and it's a miracle that we're having this weather right now. But food cart life can be rough that way, you know. Your customers are amazing for coming out and sitting in the rain sometimes mm-hmm. to wait for your food, and they did that, which I just like. God bless them all.
Well, it speaks to how delicious your tortas are that they're willing to get a little damp.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk about the space because you've spoken a lot about kind of the importance of design to the whole hospitality experience, to the experience of your restaurant. So I'd love to hear about kind of what was your inspiration when you designed the brick and mortar restaurant. What are you trying to communicate? What sort of atmosphere do you want to create for your guests?
Yeah, that was another interesting part about the shift, because I think in the food cart, we kind of did as much as you possibly could to create atmosphere and try to help like visually cue people into where they are and what the experience you want them to have would be. But again, with the rain, I would put, you know, I'd have my like floral arrangements out and my like cute little Mexican tchotchkes, and you'd turn a corner and your little paper mache, you know, thing you'd brought back from Mexico would be in a puddle somewhere, and you know, so it was a nice effort. But when we moved into the brick and mortar space, there was so much opportunity to create kind of a homey feeling and work with some people in Mexico and some people here bringing in really beautiful things that are just special artifacts. Via Raíz is a beautiful store here in Northwest, and she brings all these beautiful things from the Yucatan, and our food is really inspired by Yucatecan cooking, and so having some of her things around just kind of ties it all together for us.
We'll be right back with more stories from Feast after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin has storied cheese history that begins with Swiss, German, and Italian settlers in the 1800s and continues today with nonstop innovation and award-winning artisanship. Wisconsin was the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. It is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of this helps Wisconsin cheese win more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country. Take, for example, Decatur Swiss Cheese Co-op, who have made cheese since the 1940s. Steve Stettler is a Wisconsin master cheesemaker who developed several new cheeses for the co-op, including a European-style Havarti, a Swiss lace cheese called Stettler Swiss, and a Colby Swiss marbled cheese. His cheeses have won awards at the Wisconsin State Fair and the World Championship Cheese Contest. To learn more about Wisconsin's award-winning cheesemakers, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Meet and Three's recap of HRN's trip to Feast Portland. If you're talking about culinary success stories in Portland, you can't pass up the chance to hear from Maya Lovelace. She used the small savings from a garage pop-up and a Kickstarter campaign to open two of Portland's biggest eateries, May and Yonder. Listen in as she speaks with Alex McCrary, co-host of HRN's restaurant business show Opening Soon, about what she learned from the crowdfunding experience.
It was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month probably of
because crowdfunding is crowdfunding sounds super exciting and super like, you know, accessible, but then it's got to be the ultimate way of really putting yourself out there.
It is. Yeah.
How long did you guys have, cuz every Kickstarter has a window until you raise the amount of money, right? Is it set or you get to choose with that?
You get to choose. We heard from people that 30 days was the best amount of time to do it, so we did it for 30 days. And I think we hit our target the day before the end of our campaign or maybe 2 days before. It was like a blur for me.
Cool. So, and then you guys offered everything from a basket of chicken, which is really cool. I would have certainly invested had I lived close enough to get your basket of chicken.
For sure. That's nice.
To like a $10,000 restaurant buyout.
We tried to offer a really nice array of things at lots of different price points. So it was like, you know, you could get a little enamel pin with our drumstick logo on it. Or like you said, you could get, you know, a restaurant buyout, or you could get, you know, us coming and cooking at your house. Kind of like the old pop-up days.
Did any takers on that?
Yeah.
That's
one.
Cool.
Yeah. And, you know, in between we had, you know, like a winemaker dinner. We did a recipe testing dinner so that people would get kind of a first glimpse at what the menu of Yonder was going to be like. So we tried really hard to make sure that the people who loved us could find a way to afford to support us.
Right.
Yeah.
Another test of, you know, what Kickstarter is being stressed about delivering once you've now accepted all this money.
Yeah. That's another thing about crowdfunding is that you're not only opening yourself up to like weird ridicule, you're also opening yourself up to people who have access to make crazy demands from you. So it's, yeah, really intense experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to like complain. Like I'm very, very happy that we did it. I'm very happy that we are where we are, but I want to be really open and honest about that for all of you who are out there, maybe thinking about doing crowdfunding, make sure you are emotionally prepared.
So Kickstarter, you raised 85 grand.
Yep.
You had 100 grand from pop-ups.
Yep.
185 grand is still not enough to open a restaurant.
It's true.
What did you do?
We ended up actually taking on a couple of partners. We have two partners in the restaurant, both people that we knew, people that we loved already, which I think is really crucial. A lot of people ask me how to find the right partner. And we courted a few people that had a ton of money, but that we didn't necessarily feel like we could ride into the sunset with. That's kind of how somebody described it. Like when you're taking on a partner, that's somebody you want to ride off into the sunset with. That's like your person. They're like attached to you for the tenure of this restaurant being open.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you think that they were influenced by the Kickstarter support at all?
I think that they might have been. I think that it, you know, they saw it as something that, you know, had support. And then the fact that we were also able to come to the table with that money, right, as well as our little nest egg that we had saved up.
Right.
You know, we had skin in the game as well. Like, we weren't just saying, give us your money, we're going to run with it, and hopefully we'll do something successful. We were like, we're also investing in this personally.
It's definitely a big thing that, that investors look for, I think, is to see that you're taking the risk beyond, obviously, the time, sweat, equity that you're putting into it, but that you're, yeah, financially taking the risk yourself, which is pretty daunting for a chef. And you know, I'm sure most people know, but chefs don't make a ton of money when they're in restaurants. So
it's true.
The idea of saving up $100,000 within less than 15 years as a chef is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Kudos for getting that done.
Thank you.
Finally, we talked to Tyler Malik, the co-founder of the ice cream company Salt and Straw, which was one of our generous supporters at Feast. Dana Cowan, host of Speaking Broadly, got the scoop, pun intended, about how he's franchising the business in a whole new way.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Tyler up and changed his life and decided to move and to make ice cream with his cousin Kim. You bought like a used ice cream maker to make your first flavors.
Yeah, is that three used ice cream makers from Goodwill.
Okay.
And they were $4 each.
That was a very good $12 investment.
It was a lot of money at the time, yeah, though. And yeah, we made ice cream from scratch. And this idea of like just having fun with flavors and using ice cream, like just cream and sugar as this foundation to like go off on journeys, flavor journeys, and learn about the city around us. That was like our philosophy from day one. And it just so happened we were in Portland, which is like the coolest city to go on a flavor journey in.
That's true. So what are the plans? Like, it feels like such a Portland brand, but of course, yeah, you're throughout, I mean, you're really well distributed, actually.
Yeah, we've been...
And now you're in New York.
Kinda. Small.
With Joe's.
Yeah.
And with Daily Provisions.
Yeah.
But, like, what are the expansion plans? Like, how much of the rest of America gets to have Salt and Straw? Well, you can mail order it, of course, but in their hometown.
Yeah, I mean...
Scoop Shop.
For us, for some reason, we picked the hardest expansion model in the world.
What was that?
Every city you go to, the Salt and Straw is completely different than any other city.
And that means, like, design, flow, flavors?
Exactly. All of it.
Wow.
And you know, that local manager is embedded in their community. Yeah. And we, you know, we own all our own shops, and we feel strongly that, like, this experience is special. And we want to foster it. And, of course, we want to grow it because we feel like the world needs some of that happiness. Mm-hmm. But we can't just, like, copy and paste it around the world.
So I'm curious, like, I'm deeply curious, like, more curious than the listeners, probably, but, you know, how you are going to be part of those communities and not end up, like, just another box. It's a local manager who's in the community, and then, but you must control the flavors from Central.
Yeah, I'm able to control the flavors here in Portland. That's my job. But, you know, when we opened in L.A., I basically lived in L.A. for 6 months before we ever opened our shop, and, 3 months before we opened, we had a kitchen there in downtown LA. We were making everything. We found, I mean, it's far more than, like, of course we found a local dairy and we, you know, found these amazing farms, but it's embedding yourself in that city and it's having a food cart and going to all the farmers markets, you know? It's like all these things becoming part of kind of the daily dialogue in that city. And what's wild is even today, I would say there's about, I mean, this is going to hurt some Portlanders' feelings, but about 40% of people that live in L.A. still think we started in L.A. And, you know,
that's
I think...
sort of shocking, yeah.
That's the biggest compliment to me in my entire life, because that was what we went out to do. We wanted to say, like, I have this dream of somehow expanding a business, and instead of exporting our product, let's export our culture. And that's way different.
Yeah.
We call it the... can't say this on radio.
Yes, you can.
It's the screw you McDonald's model.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Because we love this idea of, like, we want to grow. We think that's important. And we think we're doing something really you know, world changing
right.
at Salt and Straw. But it's not going to be just this copy and paste McMansion right. model. And so it's really fun and exciting and it's inspiring.
Yeah. It's probably slow as well.
Very slow yeah. and very intentional.
Yeah.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. To hear more of our coverage from Feast Portland, look for Heritage Radio Network on tour wherever you listen to podcasts. Next week, we investigate whether there's a cost to all the convenience of food delivery that we haven't considered. Special thanks this week to the incredible team at Feast Portland for including us in this year's festival. Thanks, too, to all the pickles at Little Green Pickle. And so much gratitude to Le Creuset, Salt and Straw, Travel Portland, and the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts for making our coverage of Feast Portland possible. Meat and Three is produced by Hannah Forden, Kat Johnson, Liza Hamm, and me, Katie Mosman-Wadler. Thanks to H. Connolly and Nicole Cornwall for additional production support. Our audio engineer is Matt Patterson. Our theme song was composed by Breakmaster Cylinder. Meat and Three is a production of Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org and follow us at heritage_radio. And please stay in touch. Whether you have a story idea or would just like to say hey, write us at ideas@meatandthree.nyc. That's all spelled out.
Meat and Three is powered by Simple.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.